We have been doing better at mitigating the loss of bone. In astronauts, it used to be 1 to 2% per month of loss, where aging females would lose 1% per year. So we've been able to mitigate that some with exercise, with vitamin D, with the diet, with and even in some cases tested bisphosphonates to try to mitigate that. So we know that we can slow it down. We cannot necessarily eliminate it.
Greetings and salutations, everybody. Welcome back to another week with Drew and Alex here at Mops and Mo's. Closing out our four-part NASA series, Alex, this week we have...
We have Judy Hayes, and as you might expect from somebody with the job title of Chief Science Officer of the Human Health and Performance Directorate at NASA's Johnson Space Center, she has a pretty impressive resume. So strap in. There's going to be a little bit here. It's all great stuff. She came to Johnson Space Center in 1984 as a research scientist in the neurosciences laboratory. She established the exercise physiology laboratory in 1987. She was principal investigator on two space shuttle experiments studying the effects of microgravity on skeletal muscle performance in astronauts. We hear a little bit about that in this episode. During her career, she managed the physiology laboratories, reduced gravity programs, space medicine project, and integration of biomedical research for the space shuttle, Russian Mir shuttle, and International Space Station programs. In addition to Johnson Space Center, she managed NASA laboratories at the Gagarin Cosmonaut Training Center in Star City, Russia, as well. Her scope involves extensive collaboration with the Japanese, European, and Canadian space agencies, including membership in the International Countermeasures Working Group for developing global standards for spaceflight exercise and research. She also publishes papers and book chapters on spaceflight exercise physiology, and lectures for various undergraduate programs at the University of Texas and various training programs for flight surgeons and astronaut candidates. Judy earned her Bachelor of Science and Master of Science in Exercise Physiology from West Virginia University, followed by a Master of Public Health degree in Occupational Health / Aerospace Medicine from University of Texas Health Sciences Center. She completed a joint fellowship at the Royal College of Surgeons in England and the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, supporting epidemiologic research in the development of clinical practice guidelines for the National Health Service in the United Kingdom. She's won a bunch of awards, distinguished graduate kind of stuff, as well as the NASA Silver Snoopy Award.
Sorry, what is a Silver Snoopy?
It's the astronauts' own award for outstanding performance. So that's an award the astronauts give to people who support them in exceptional ways.
The Silver Snoopy. So, yeah, I mean, it goes without saying here that Judy is very accomplished, very intelligent, and I couldn't think of a better way to capstone this four-part series. We've kind of gone from the boots on the ground perspective, so to speak, with the astronaut. Then we've gone through the human performance element of NASA with the staff, the ACER staff, and then now to get sort of the, I guess, the bird's eye umbrella view of where this entire program is going and some of the things that they are interested in from a scientific perspective. Truly fascinating. You know, this is one of those episodes that you could listen to on its own, and it definitely stands on its own. But as with the other three, we would encourage folks to sort of go through the whole series to gain the ideal perspective of what human performance at NASA truly looks like.
Especially now, I don't know how many people are paying really close attention to spaceflight stuff. There's been some cool developments. The Artemis mission is progressing. We're hopefully going to have astronauts back on the moon real soon. Whee! And if you've been following along with our episodes, and I think it gets discussed in this one a little bit, but the International Space Station has been the entire focus of a lot of NASA stuff for a while, or at least the manned NASA activities. We've certainly sent probes farther out. But that mission is coming to a close in just a few years, and they plan to hand over low Earth orbit to commercial interests, meaning more quote unquote civilians go into space, right?
Means Elon Musk.
Right. It means a lot of things. It means that there's going to be a lot of talk about, like, how do we keep humans safe and healthy in space when they're not military or government kind of professional astronauts? And it means that NASA is going to be shifting their focus to longer duration, farther, more extreme type of missions, things that might include like possible permanent settlements on the moon and things like that. Some really, really crazy stuff is on the horizon, or probably above the horizon, depending on what time of day it is, if you're looking at the moon. but we got some really neat things that they're going to have to grapple with in terms of the microgravity of being in space, the fractional gravity of being on the moon and Mars, all sorts of crazy stuff that figuring out how humans handle that stuff is a really neat problem set to be working on.
Yeah, so come with us today as we go to infinity and beyond. Enjoy.
Okay, well, I wanted to ask Judy, because I have no real clue. I know Alex knows a little bit more than I do about the human performance research space over at NASA. But if I have this correct, your official job title is Chief Science Officer for NASA's Human Health and Performance Directorate. Would you agree that is the coolest job title in all of physiology?
I don't know if it's the coolest job title. It's a new title for me. Because in the past I was a division chief over all the research labs. And so this is a new journey for me as being chief science officer. So I'm excited to be here.
I know you can't answer this question, but is there a chief science officer for NASA's non-human health and performance directorate?
There are other chief, well, there's a NASA headquarters chief scientist for everything. So I'm just a small part of that.
What is your purview, I suppose, as that kind of lead from the physiology standpoint?
Well, it's physiology, environmental sciences, medicine, you know, whatever we're doing, as far as science and research. And a big part of my job is policy and research integrity, which is great. You know, we have lots of scientists that know how to do science, but then we have others like engineers and clinicians that may not be, you know, that are engaging in research, which I think is great. So part of this is to develop our scientists and others in how to do science, but also engage in partnerships. So we have partnerships with industry and academia and also with the military, with the DOD. So it's setting up some of those partnerships and encouraging collaborations.
We sort of asked this question in a couple of different ways, I think, to the human performance team, and then sort of actually, you know, Shane as an actual astronaut, mm-hmm. but mentioning partnerships, and this might go into a little bit of a tangent, but one of the things I'm curious about is this kind of commercialization of space and what that means for sending human beings into outer space who may obviously not have the same amount of training or prep or, quite frankly, research behind them that you guys do. What are some of the physiological consequences that we could anticipate from that kind of thing? Or will it be as easy as hopping on a Delta flight and going to Los Angeles?
Well, maybe someday. first of all, commercialization of space is really a game changer. It's very exciting for all of us, and NASA's excited about it, and we're here to try to enable that. And we want people to leverage the 60 years of NASA space flight knowledge and experience so that they don't have to reinvent the wheel, so to speak. So we are here to share what we know. The evidence that we know to date is published and on, you know, it's published in the literature, but it's also published in these evidence books on a website, on one of the human research programs websites. So we've done the homework for people. Please use it. And we try to update those every year or two to make sure that it's pretty updated. So again, you know, we're here to help. And, you know, while we're engaging in human exploration beyond low Earth orbit, and most of the commercializations, you know, closer to Earth and low Earth orbit, or now going to the moon, please use us as an agent to try to help the commercial industry get there. So we're trying to solve our problems and leverage what we know to engage the commercial industry. Now, as the general population can fly into space for 4 minutes or 4 days or 2 weeks, we are going to learn a lot about what happens to the humans that aren't government astronauts or aren't professional astronauts. And that's going to be kind of exciting for us too, is to see how the general population responds to spaceflight. I think that's exciting. You know, that's an area we have not studied. We've been studying astronauts who have been well screened for health and fitness. And so we have a kind of a tight semi-homogeneous population. And when you start getting, you know, broadening that experience, we will see probably, you know, different responses. So we're excited to see how people respond to those things.
That brings up some behavioral science kind of stuff that we've chatted about on this podcast before. I think in addition to the astronauts you've sent before being well screened for health and fitness, they're also pretty well screened professionally for following orders and like doing the exercise they're told to do and all that kind of stuff. Do you worry at all that there's a concern with, as we send people into space, that won't be as regulated, that'll be having like a lot more just kind of do what they want to do? How do we keep them doing the kinds of things that current astronauts have to do to maintain bone density, muscle mass, all that kind of stuff?
Right. Well, you know, astronauts are human too, even though they're well-trained and well-vetted, and they have their preferences. So sometimes they, they are professional astronauts, so this is a career for them. But, you know, they do respond in normal human ways. So, you know, if they have a preference, we try to accommodate that, especially when it comes to, you know, the exercises. There's only so many accommodations we can make when it's in spaceflight, but we try to accommodate, if they like to run, you know, we try to give them prescriptions that give them that. You know, they give them that, but there is a prescription we're trying to get folks to follow that we feel like can optimize their health and performance. And some do it and some don't. I will say most, we can find a prescription that is preferential to them and still gets the job done. But yeah, they're in many ways like everyone else, even though they're heavily screened.
That touched on several of the topics we had on our last conversation with the ACER team. So that leads me to ask, how frequent, how strong is the collaboration between the research side of the house and the folks who are handling those prescriptions and like giving the training to the astronauts?
Well, first, let me say that what we call the research side of the house, the unique part about those laboratories is every single one of them has an operational or clinical role as well as a research role, which is usually unique. And the ACERs are semi-funded by the laboratory. They work very tightly. So you'll see some of the laboratory exercise physiologists working in the gym because they also are CSCS certified. And so they can, you know, practice exercise training and fitness as well as do research in the lab. And similarly, some of the ACERs get engaged in some of the research. You know, we almost have to have that synergy between the two. And whether they're working with the exercise phys lab or the neurosciences lab or the nutritional biochemists, they do work across many of those disciplines, which is great. It hasn't always been that way, but I think that the culture is such that we have to do that in order to advance the prescriptions of, you know, and advance the way we develop countermeasures for the health of the astronauts and performance of the astronauts. So I think it's a great synergy between the two.
You think, I'm glad you mentioned that, because again, that's another thing that we talked about when we had the ACERs on. And I think in the military space and really in sort of the collegiate and professional sports space, one of the things you hear a lot about is this, I don't want to say a rift, but certainly a gap between the research side of exercise science and the practical application side. So much so that you could almost label some strength coaches as like, oh, he's like a data guy. And the other coaches don't even know how to make an abstract. And a theme that keeps coming up on the NASA side of the house is that you guys have a really nice synergy, like you mentioned, between the lab-based stuff and the practical stuff. So I know you sort of just touched on this, but I'd be curious from your perspective, what kind of lessons learned have you seen as you created that relationship? Because I know that it's something that this industry, being strength and conditioning, seems to be lacking. And it's something that I know a lot of coaches want to see improve, this, you know, synergy between research and application.
So I won't say it's perfect. We have, before we had ACERS, the exercise lab or the, you know, were invited into the gym by the astronauts personally to come help them train. And that's when we started realizing and getting ready back in the day for Hubble, for the Hubble EVAs to repair the Hubble Space Telescope. We realized that we needed a dedicated group of folks that could go and be there all the time and help the astronauts. Many of the ACERs, not all, but many have come through the lab, started in the lab, and then transitioned over to be an ACER. So they have a really intense understanding of what's going on, what's coming, moving forward as, you know, new countermeasures and studies are being developed. So that helps the synergy. And then in the past, we've also had like a job swap. A job swap where you have an ACER full-time in the lab and then one of the lab folks full-time in the gym. So we have worked hard to keep that synergy tight. Like I said, it's still not perfect, but I think it's you know, it's pretty well improved over the years, and there's lots of ways to do that. So, yeah, and they're very respectful of each other and work together. You know, we're developing new, when we're developing new exercise countermeasures, we will invite the ACERs to be part of that, you know, human in the loop testing and procedure writing and all those things, and also engage our engineers. So it really is a community. And flight surgeons, I don't want to leave out the flight docs. So it is a community. It isn't just, you know, an individual or two individuals at the end. They're just, you know, at the end of the spear, there's a group of folks that are really coming together to try to manage and optimize crew health and performance.
Do you think that that's a product of, I suppose, the, it might sound dramatic, but like the life or death aspect of the mission? I mean, you're literally putting humans in space, which is an incredibly foreign environment. Like, do you think that's what drives the common goal across all those disciplines? Or is it more just a product of like, hey, this is how effective human performance needs to be done at a high level?
Having a common goal is certainly makes things easier. And I know, you know, in athletics, you have that often. In the military, you have that. So it certainly drives home why we're here and why we need to work together. So I wouldn't want to minimize the importance of having that common goal. And I think that's not just in space. You know, we have big big goals that everybody can see, but, you know, other occupations have common goals as well. And I think that can be leveraged to bring a team together.
So with that team all working on these problems, I guess a two-part question. What are some of the biggest challenges you guys have overcome when it comes to human performance stuff in space? And then as you look towards the future, longer duration space flight kind of stuff, what are the biggest challenges you see on the horizon?
Oh my gosh. You know, there's many. You're doing things in space is hard. Space is hard and extremely remote. And the further they get away, the more remote it is.
Literally.
It is literally. And it is hard. It's, and you know, you can't just buy a treadmill and put it on a, you know, on a space station. You have to engage a lot of creativity in across that community. The engineers have the hard job. You know, we think we need to keep people healthy and fit. The engineers have to figure out a way to get that into whatever vehicle we're flying on. And there are so many restrictions and limitations from weight and volume and power and, you know, launch loads. And you can't impart any kind of, you know, as you're running on a treadmill, you can't impart those foot forces into the vehicle. So you have to isolate. You know, one of the biggest challenges in exercise anyway is isolation of a device from the vehicle itself and still get the proper exercise loads. So when you see a cycle ergometer or a treadmill or this resistance exercise device working on station, all that is isolated from the vehicle, but still giving the loads the crews need. And the engineering challenges associated with that are massive. It's really quite difficult. I would say also just how we restrain a astronaut on the device. So we have to get clever about how you can run on a treadmill, because if you don't have a harness to hold you down, you will not be running on a treadmill very long. So so making those accommodations for running in space or lifting, you know, a resistance in space, I'd say weight, but it's not weight, a resistance in space, or riding a cycle ergometer in space, and being able to load them the way properly or give them the resistance they need properly, you really have to have that that vibration isolation system, and you have to have a proper harnessing to it so that we can properly exercise them. And those harnesses sometimes are very uncomfortable. So it's really quite a journey to develop that capability. And it really is a partnership between the physiologists and the ACERs and the docs and the crew have to be engaged, and also our engineers. So we have not fully perfected those. There's always room for improvement, but we've done pretty well. We've done pretty well for the crew. On station anyway.
So this is a real cheesy question that came to mind as you were answering that, with like ARED and all the systems you have in place. I routinely get advertisements for eSTIM devices that promise to like activate your muscles and give you abs while you're lying on the couch and all that stuff. Obviously questioning their claims a little bit, but I've also seen them trying to like get that into military acquisition systems and things like that. I assume NASA had to like at least look at those things to see if there was any feasibility there. And I don't hear you guys using them a lot. Did that happen?
So I'll tell you just in general, make a general statement about, we get a lot, probably the military, the sports industry, we all get approached by the latest new widget, right? That can make you fit. We have a series of requirements for what we need for spaceflight. And so we compare anything that comes to us against those requirements. And, you know, if it's, you know, I don't know the list off the top of my head, but if there's 10 requirements and you hit three, you know, it may not be meet our needs. So we try to do it objectively. We try to measure our assessments objectively that way, so that, and we share those, you know, with folks that come to us. We'll share those requirements with them and tell them, okay, well, you know, this is what we really need. And then they can go off and try to make adjustments or not. It just, you know, space is different, and you know, it's different than doing exercise in a gym or in your backyard or in your garage or wherever you do your exercise. So we have specific requirements that things have to meet.
You guys, because I know we've seen the videos and we've talked about kind of the three pieces of equipment that get used, the resistance training piece, the cycle ergometer, and the treadmill. And it seems like those three things have stayed relatively fixed for a long time. Is there like, what's on the horizon in terms of equipment? Is that going to stay kind of the suite of equipment, or will you guys add things or take things away, or what might change for those three pieces?
So we're always looking for ways to improve. It's very expensive to change those out. We have the current treadmill is our second treadmill. So we have upgraded our treadmill about 10 years ago, I guess. We have, in fact, we're in the process of replacing our cycle ergometer to a new one. So you'll see a new one in the coming months. And we have tested out other technologies as what we'll call a technology demonstration. So we don't go operational until we know these things work. We have looked at others as technology demonstrations on station, and because they haven't worked, we haven't changed. We haven't added those to our suite. We are getting ready to fly another device that is called an E4D that has been developed by the Danish aerospace company. And in fact, the Danish aerospace company has made, they've built our cycle ergometer also. So they have experience building flight hardware. And this is called an E4D, and it's one device, but it has four modalities in it. So it has a rower and a cycle ergometer and a resistance exercise device and a rope pull. So that will launch soon, and we will do some technology demonstration exercises on it to see how it works. And then we expect to be using it for an upcoming study if it's deemed functional for spaceflight. And we'll leave it on station. We'll use it for a study actually the study has already started, but it will add a dimension to that study. So yeah, excited to see, you know, some new hardware.
I didn't even think about rowing. That's a good point.
Yeah. So we have had rowers. We flew two rowers on the space shuttle as demonstrations. We flew them on the mid deck of the space shuttle.
So a question on that, this is all based on like the situation that a space station provides in terms of the amount of space involved, how long people are there, all those kinds of things. And if I'm not mistaken, we're inside of 10 years of end of mission for the space station, and we're starting to look more and more towards longer duration, farther distance kind of space flight stuff. Does that require like a pretty complete rethinking of what equipment can be put on whatever platform you're looking at, and where is your team at with that stuff?
So indeed we do. So we look at all the different, we call them design reference missions. So all the different types of missions that are upcoming. So it could be, so we're in long duration. How we categorize station right now is long duration, low Earth orbit. But there may be shorter duration, low Earth orbit, like shuttle or shorter station missions. They're going to be shorter, you know, sorties that go to the moon and then eventually on the moon and then longer missions on the moon. And then, of course, anything going to Mars is long duration. So we look at those and then we try to qualify what the requirements are for each one of those types of missions. So indeed, when we go to the moon, Artemis II on the Orion, we will have an exercise device. We fought hard, long and hard to get one on there. And they gave us about the volume of a little bit bigger than a shoebox. And it also has to double as a step. So, so as I said, there are certain requirements that come along with flying things in space. So we will be flying for the first time a flywheel device. And it's small. We're testing it out right now. We're doing some human in the loop testing right now in the lab, which we're engaging astronauts, flight surgeons, ACERs, and of course the lab personnel. And we will fly that on Artemis II with this first crew that's going out and back. And I can't wait to get their feedback, but it is similar to a rowing capability, but there'll also be some resistance capability on it as well. But we will learn a lot. We've never successfully flown a flywheel. So we will learn a lot. This is an unproven device. So we're excited to get the ball rolling there.
This may come across as a dumb question, but as you were talking about exercise equipment, it came to my mind because previously everything that we've referenced has to function almost gyroscopically as you orbit through space. Does that change when you get into conversations about setting up permanent installations on things like the moon? Now you don't have to deal with navigating orbit and all of that, and it's fixed, but we still have the issue of not having gravity. So like, how does that, is that part of the conversation, or am I just out here on a limb somewhere?
No, it's always part of the conversation. You know, we're going to be, that's a different design reference mission, right? If you're actually on a surface, it kind of changes the rules a bit. Mm-hmm. And you may have more volume to work with. You know, in space station, we have quite a bit of volume. On Orion, it is not very large in there. And so that's why we were relegated to this small volume that they gave us. And of course, no power.
Yeah, that's true.
So once we get to a surface, say the surface of the moon, and they have missions where they're going to stay a little bit longer than a week or two, we will install some type of exercise capability there, because we do not know what the contribution of 1/6 gravity is to maintaining your health and fitness. Mm-hmm. So we kind of have an idea of what 1 gravity does and what 0 gravity does or microgravity does, But we do not know what the contribution of 1/6 gravity, which is the gravity on the moon, or 1/3 gravity, which is the gravity on Mars, will, how that will contribute to maintaining your, you know, your bone and muscle and cardiovascular condition. So that will be something new for us to learn.
Is there a way, I mean, and I can't imagine that you could, but how do you figure that out without just actually putting someone there? Is it just kind of you wing it and hope and give your best guess and then you send them up there and hope the data lines up with what you hypothesized?
Well, we try not to wing anything.
Educated guess.
We do have various capabilities for us to test some things. So there's various analogs where, you know, of course, we can fly in parabolic flight. You know, we can do microgravity. We can also do Martian and lunar gravity. So we can test some of the hardware in those environments. What we can't really test is, and we can test maybe the biomechanics of operating in those environments and maybe model some things with that data. We also use other analogs like bed rest. So we use a 6-degree head down bed rest to model zero gravity. And we do have a lunar gravity model that's similar for bed rest that helps us assess what are the physiological changes that we might be able to expect for a lunar mission. But lunar missions are going to be very different. We're going to be doing a lot of EVAs or a lot of spacewalks on the surface. And they're just going to be very different. And you have this partial gravity. So there, you know, at some point, you know, we will have to do the assessments on the surface itself. Yeah. But we can do a lot of things to learn about a lot of physiology and behavioral health before we get there. And in fact, you may have heard the Chepia experiment that's ongoing right now. It's a 373-day Martian mission that's in a habitat on site at the Johnson Space Center.
I heard about that.
So we have four people living in a habitat, Martian habitat, for over a year. They're just this week, 378 days, they hit their 100-day mark. So we were celebrating that with them. And they have an outside Martian surface where they do EVAs, or they do their spacewalks, and they use some virtual reality while they're doing the tasks and the spacewalks. But it's a very large experiment, and four very brave people who have volunteered to do this. They're quite remarkable. They're very astronaut-like. They scoured, you know, the United States to find candidates for that. And there's an engineer, two scientists, and a physician that are the crew. So they definitely are astronaut-like as test subjects. And things seem to be going quite well in there.
Well, I remember, so I used to live in Tucson, and the biosphere was right up the road. And, you know, it was all, I don't remember when they did that experiment. You know, they basically locked people in there for an extended period of time. And anytime I hear about people doing that, I think back to the biosphere. Oh, you know, like, it was great. And then they had some issues with personalities and blah, 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 blah. It's like, man, I cannot imagine being locked somewhere on Earth, pretending like you're in space for over a year. That would be interesting.
Yeah. The Chepia habitat is much smaller than the biosphere. And we did a very, you know, we did a vigorous assessment of the test subject candidates. Did a lot of, just as we do with astronauts, when we're selecting astronauts, you do a lot of the you know, the health assessments, but also the behavioral health assessments. So yeah, it's a stellar team, and we're excited to see how things come out, but they've got 270 something days left.
Oof, good luck.
Yeah.
I want to ask you, and maybe stepping away from exercise equipment specifically, but with everything that you're looking at and have looked at over the years, I mean, space is such an insane concept to think about. Is there anything that you guys have discovered or found out that just makes you kind of take a step back and go like, wow, that is crazy, relative to how the human body reacts or anything pertaining to exercise science in this field? Like, because I can imagine you guys would discover some things and you're like, the human body is insane.
The human body is remarkable. it really is how quickly it can adapt to its environments. I mean, and you see that on Earth, right? You see that on Earth. But space is a very hazardous environment and challenging environment, and the body does adapt rather quickly. Everybody adapts at a different rate and in a different way. And as you know, the physiology, we study the physiology pretty closely on how that occurs. And what we do know is even with this very healthy crew, with a very healthy crew, they all adapt differently and they all respond to their countermeasures differently. So we have to tailor as much as we can to each crew member. So for sure, they adapt on their way up. Once they get to space, takes about on station anyway, it takes about 30 days to kind of level off, and hit their, I like to say it's they hit their zero gravity homeostasis, and then they're good for a while. I mean, they still may be deconditioned. Some of the systems still may be deconditioning. And then when they come home, they rapidly start adjusting to gravity, even on the way in. Again, different systems respond differently and are slower to readapt to their earth-based homeostasis. But many things happen, and you can watch. We do watch it as crew members have returned home over days and weeks and months and years. So some things we'll monitor just, for the first 45 days, which is that recovery phase where we protect them and they get 2 hours of training and rehab for 45 days. But we still follow them for, 6 months, a year on certain things that might respond more slowly, like bone responds more slowly than the sensory motor system, which responds rapidly. And so we'll follow them, but we also follow astronauts' health even after retirement. So we'll have them come back and do follow-up exams, their physical exams over, years, even after they retire, so we can see what the long-term health consequences might be of spaceflight.
So while you guys were talking about that, I was kind of glancing through some of the Chappia stuff because it's fascinating. But my question is about how you approached the exercise and human performance portion of the Chappia experiment, because it from what pictures are out there, it looks like there's a rower, a bike, a bench, and then like a couple tough tread modified curve treadmills. How were those things selected for it, and like what are you trying to simulate there?
So the team of scientists, so there's a team of scientists that came together to decide what that would look like. And they tried to make it look like what we would have when we get to Mars. So you'd have resistance exercise, you'd have a cycle ergometer, you would have, similar to what we have on station, and then you'd have a treadmill and rowing capability. And part of that is for entertainment, it's for health, it's for behavioral health, it's for, blowing off steam, it's, time away. Exercise meets a lot of needs. And just like in space, if the treadmill breaks, they have to fix it. There's, or anything, if the toilet breaks, they have to fix it. All those things, we don't send in, the gremlins at night that fix everything up to make it perfect while they sleep and then sneak out. We don't do that. But so they may have to do some repairs and updates and those sorts of things, just as a crew would do in space. But they were pretty much selected based on what our anticipation of, being able to recover a crew after a 6 to 9 month mission of microgravity to get there and make sure that they are healthy and fit enough to do an EVA in one-third gravity. So it's really an estimation of what we think we'll have to be doing once we get to Mars to keep them healthy.
I wanted to originally ask this question rather simply, which was like if there was one singular piece of equipment you could add to the current options, like what would it be? But broadening that more to like a physiological question, when you think about the long duration type space flight, is there kind of one gnawing question or one gnawing unknown thing thing that you guys are curious about and wondering how you might address it with an additional piece of training equipment or with some additional resources that you might be able to allow on a longer duration mission like that, if that makes sense?
So that's a great question.
Oh, thank you.
I'll say we're always looking for the next best thing. So we're always doing kind of a tech watch to see what's out there that might add to the suite that we have for station and might be just the perfect thing to send to Mars or the moon. So with that said, we're always seeking the next thing. What we have on station is a complement. You know, it's a suite of exercises that we think are not redundant, but they complement each other. And the other thing is, if one thing goes down, we can quickly shift the prescription to address, aerobic capacity or skeletal muscle strength. There are certain things that we can't, that they're unique. Each device is a little bit unique for, but we try to make it so this complement can cover most our bases of what we know we see in losses and musculoskeletal, sensory motor, aerobic capacity, all those things. So it's good to have a complement. You know, it's a little scary when we're forced to just have one device, because if that breaks, then we have nothing. And that's never good. So I'll leave it at that. The thing is, there's things that we don't know yet. Mm-hmm. We're always learning. We uncover things. You know, there's not a large sample size of people that have flown in space for long periods of time. And as our population spends more time, has more exposure, other things start to be revealed. It was just, maybe 10 years ago that the eye issues started to reveal themselves after crew members were in space for 2 or 3 months. And we had not seen that before. So we are still studying this space flight associated neuroocular syndrome, as we've coined it, SANS. And it is, it doesn't happen to everybody. And some people express their symptoms differently than others. So it's been very hard to wrap our arms around it. We don't have an understanding of the mechanism, full mechanism, on why it happens to some and not to others. We haven't come up with a full countermeasure for it yet. We're still testing countermeasures. We've finally come up with an analog, an Earth-based analog, where we can study it on Earth. But we didn't have, all this takes time. And when you're only getting 2 or 3 or 4 people per year, American astronauts a year flying, and only a portion of them actually get the condition, it's very difficult to get an understanding of. So there are things out there that we know we don't know yet, and that will reveal themselves and offer us new challenges. And, once we get to the surface of the moon or the surface to Mars, who knows, that'll be a whole new world for us too. So we'll always be looking for countermeasures that can address holistically the body as much as possible, and to try to keep people healthy, but we'll see. Keeps it interesting.
So I know we're starting to get close to your hard stop here, and I want to be respectful of your time. Mm-hmm. So as kind of like a wrap up question, a huge theme across all of NASA's work has been that discoveries you make in the course of preparing for and executing spaceflight have relevance and applicability for those of us stuck here on 1G
Earthlings,
or Earth surface, right? So what are some examples of things you've learned about human health and performance that can enhance the way we approach those topics for people who aren't going to space?
Okay. Well, first I can say that we use an awful lot of terrestrial medicine to inform what we're going to do, that's where we start, what we're going to do in spaceflight. There are many examples of how spaceflight has, with now what we call NASA spinoffs, and how it's benefited Earth, the Earth challenges. A couple things with exercise. One thing we know is astronauts do better when they eat well and they exercise. Boy, that's revolutionary, isn't
it? Shocking. Yeah,
out of this world.
So, you know, what we're told on Earth applies in space in that case. One of my favorite examples of what we have learned that we couldn't have really learned here is with bone physiology and how quickly bone can be lost with unloading in space, and how some of our countermeasures can try to mitigate that. The other thing is how bone recovers. So when the astronauts, even though, you know, we have been doing better at mitigating the loss of bone in astronauts, it used to be 1-2% per month of loss, where aging, you know, aging females would lose 1% per year. So we've been able to mitigate that some with exercise, with vitamin D, with the diet, with and even in some cases we've tested bisphosphonates to try to mitigate that. So we know that we can slow it down. We cannot necessarily eliminate it. So some people lose more bone than others. Like I said, there's a lot of individual variability. So some may lose, even with all the countermeasures that we throw at them, some will still lose more than others. The cool thing is when they come back, what we've been able to watch is how they recover once they do come back to Earth and they are exposed to one gravity and they go through their rehabilitation and recovery phase. The bone itself, there's cortical bone and there's trabecular bone. And the cortical, both, we lose both types of bone in space. But when they recover on Earth, the cortical bone gets thicker. But though the webbing, I call the infrastructure, the architecture of the trabecular bone, once those strands are broken, they do not recover. So the two types of bone recover differently. And we're not quite yet sure on what that does to fracture risk. But while your bone density may come back, the actual architecture changes. So it's really kind of cool to watch. It's cool that we've been able to recover bone. You know, it was really great to know that when crew members who came back could recover their bone density, but the whole architecture is a little bit different now.
Jeez.
So kind of interesting.
I will offer a quick shout out, especially to keep NASA public affairs happy. If you're interested in all that kind of stuff that Judy's talking about with NASA spinoffs, they have a whole page dedicated to it. And there's some super interesting stuff on there. Everything from like keeping your bed at a specific temperature to sleep better, to like thermal layers, to there's one recent one on here for like reducing wrinkles on your face. There's just about everything if you'd want to dig into the spinoff stuff.
Thank you, NASA.
I think they have over 2,000 spinoffs that they've published so far. So, yep. And Anna just put
Anna's on it. Yep,
she put it in the chat. I'm pretty sure I had already shared the spinoff page, so I didn't give it to you again.
No, yeah, I think you did. This is a different one. We've brought up the spinoffs a couple of times, so thank you. Well, Judy, I know that we've squeezed our way into your schedule, and I know you have a lot more going on today. So I want to be the first to say thank you for your time. This has been, I think, the perfect capstone to the last couple of episodes we've done with the whole human performance team and just NASA's kind of physiology program in general. So thank you.
Well, thank you for having me. Yeah, it is a community. I'm just one person. There's a huge community, and we like to include the astronauts as well to make sure that it's, you know, we're doing things that they want to embrace. Otherwise, it wouldn't work.
Very much so. Well, thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Anyway, thanks so much for having me, and good to see you guys.
Yeah.
Hey, Alex, let's cover our ass real quick.
Oh, great idea, Drew. All right, guys. The views and opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views or positions of any entities they represent.
Thanks for tuning into this week's episode. Before you go, please rate and review the pod on the listening platform of your choice. You can also visit us on our website at www.mopsinmos.com. That's mops, the letter N, mos.com. You can check out the library of podcast episodes, our latest blog entries, any helpful resources, and also sign up for our newsletter.
Drew nailed it. Just to underline a couple of things, the podcast entries have in-depth show notes on the website. So if you missed anything or you want to read any of the research we talk about, it is all there. You can, at the bottom of the website, sign up with your email and receive future updates from us. The blog posts go a little bit more in-depth in kind of written form on a couple of topics we get questions about all the time. But most importantly, I just want to ask all you guys, our best way the word gets out is absolutely word of mouth. So tell your friends, tell the people you work with, anybody you think would find it useful. Thanks for spreading the word.
If you have any questions or comments, feel free to shoot us an email at either Drew or Alex at mopsandmos.com.
Or there's a contact form on the website.
Thank you.